Kia ora e te whānau. You've got Alice and Alicia here, and we are interviewing today the Chloe Gong. Yes, you heard me right. We've got Chloe Gong here. She's promoting her newest book, and we have the very, very lucky chance to ask her a couple questions and just see what's good.
So you are here in New Zealand at the moment to promote your third book,
yes.
Our Foul Lady. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this one?
Yes. So Foul Lady Fortune is the...
I was like, did I correct her?
No.
You might have noticed us holding the bookmark being like, remember the title.
No, it's okay. Everyone will get These Violent Delights and Our Violent Ends mixed up because it's always so easy to say like These Violent Ends or Our Violent Delights. Or, like, just any combination of it. So it's classic. But don't worry. Anyway, Foul Lady Fortune is a spin-off on These Violent Delights and Our Violent Ends, but it can also stand alone because it's set 4 years after the events of the original duology, and it follows Rosalind, who we originally met in the first duology. She just kind of got, you know, the short end of the stick as far as the story goes. So I thought it'd be so much more interesting to kind of look at it from her eyes this time around. But it is set in 1931 Shanghai. It is about two spies who get fake married to take suspicion off of their identities while a series of really strange murders are going on in their city. They kind of suspect a conspiracy. The Japanese Imperial Army is marching in. You know, the invasion of World War II is about to start. So there's a lot going on politically, and they're trying to figure it out, but in the midst of it, because I love angst and drama, there's a lot of like betrayal and, you know, classic relationship drama that I think is going to be a lot of fun.
I just heard fake marriage.
I know, I was looking at you. Oh, here she goes.
And I'm sold already.
I'm glad.
Love a good fake marriage romance, and also the mixture of the historical, the political. And I guess that's one of the things which has really stood out about your book is how much you managed to cram into it in terms of the examination of Shanghai. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us forget that China did have colonization in its early history. So it's clear you put a lot of research into it, and we know you wrote this while you were staying at university. How did you find the time to do all this research and get such a tight, polished novel?
Because we were, like, fully thinking back to our uni years and being like, what did I do?
It was... I organised my schedule in such a way that I almost had every hour blocked out. Like, in one of my years, I think when I was doing, like, the heaviest part of my course load... And when I was rewriting These Violent Delights, because we rewrote it like twice after I sold it, it was just so much at once. But I knew that these were two things that I wanted to do, right? Like I really, really wanted to publish this book, but I also wanted to, you know, do my degree well. And the way that I kind of went about it was I don't want to deprioritize either one of these and I don't want to give either one of these up. So I'm going to make sure that I can... give equal amount of attention to it. And the way that I didn't like, you know, fall behind on that was by literally sorting out like, okay, from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, we're doing this, and 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, we're having a break, we're resting the brain, things like that. But I will say too, it was really helpful for me in that my degree kind of helped with the research. So I was a English and international relations major. And then in my third year, I picked up a like East Asian languages and civilizations, I think is the proper term for it. I picked up that minor because for my international relations degree, I was already taking so many classes on the kinds of topics related to my book because I was already interested in that to begin with, right? So I was taking classes about like, you know, East Asian diplomacy or like the 20th century. And I kind of pulled from that to figure out what I needed to research and what paths I was trying to take. And I guess the kinds of things that we're exposed to in academia, but like, you know, the normal audience doesn't know about these kinds of things. And I'm like, okay, this is what's going to be interesting and this is what's not as well known, and kind of like drawing that way. But it was a lot.
I think it really shows in your work. I think you definitely like deserve a round of applause for that.
Thank you.
And I know so many people have focused a lot on your age in terms of you were quite young when you first started writing, but you've already just shown, like, the amount of ambition you've had, how tightly, like, organized you've been is just phenomenal.
Oh,
and I
thanks.
Think, yeah, majesty for that.
I'll stop blushing.
And so you mentioned that when you've written a lot online about the process
yes.
of your book, and you sold mm-hmm. it, and you had it rewritten with your editor.
Mm.
And These Violent Delights ends on a cliffhanger.
Yes.
I know when I was reading it and I was getting towards the last few chapters, I was like, wait, and Romeo and Juliet, they both die and they're still not dead, so there must be more. And I got to the cliffhanger, I was like, oh no, oh no, oh no. So what was it like working with the editor to format the book? Because you changed it from one book to two, didn't you?
Yes, I did. That was one of the major changes that we went through after it sold, because I think one of the misconceptions people have about editors, especially at big publishing houses, is that they'll make you do changes or anything. But I found in my experience, it's a very, very collaborative process. It's more that they'll give me feedback of what they think is working, what they think isn't working, and they'll kind of be like, let's talk solutions, or let's talk about how you feel regarding these things that I think will work, right? So for me, like, my editor would say, what if we split it into two so that you had more time to explore, like, the relationship between, like, these two side characters? Because they're very, you know, in the original draft, like, they were rushed, they were kind of pushed aside. And I was like, yes, that's a great suggestion. I'm going to do that. Other times, like, for some recent manuscripts, like, the editor might say things like, you know, I'm not as convinced by this relationship. Like, what if we get rid of it? But then if I feel very strongly about it, I'm like, I see what angle you're coming from, but let me try fix it again, and then let's talk about this. And then if I do fix it, it's like, oh, great, like, that really worked. Let's adjust and talk about it again. And then sometimes I was like, let's go back to the drawing board. And it's one of those things where, because I really value their feedback, it helps me kind of, I guess, just trust what they're telling me, right? It doesn't feel personal. It's not like, oh, you don't like this storyline? Like, I'm really, really sad, right? It helps give that layer of removal. But with these Violent Delights and Our Valentine, like, specifically, it was like such a endeavor to, like, get from the first draft to what eventually made onto shelves, because, as you mentioned, it got cut into two. It became like 80% of it was the original manuscript for book one, and then we did a lot of, like, reorganizing, and then the original ending got put into book two, and then the rest of book two was mostly new stuff. So as we were, like, I guess, writing the new book, it was kind of like, hey, like, what do you think about this? And my editor was like, I like it, let's keep pushing at this angle or this angle or this angle. So yeah, it was very, like, you know, I give you a lot, you give me a lot. And like that.
Love it. You said in the past that you started writing online, writing fan fiction with Wattpad. Did you think that led to your openness about collaborative writing and feedback?
Oh, good question. I think so. Because I was putting a lot on Wattpad. It was like, it kind of skimmed the line between fan fiction and original fiction, because what it was technically they were all my own characters, but most of my earliest works were very, very derivative. I still remember, like, my very first book, it was essentially a ripoff of the, oh my god, what was it called? The whole series was called The Darkest Powers by Kelly Armstrong. I think the first one's called, like, The Gathering. But it was essentially just the exact same plot. Because, you know, I was, like, 13, I was like, I want to write this. I'll just write it again. Even though, content-wise, it wasn't that strong, it gave me, I guess, the experience of what it's like to just have people that you don't know, like, reading your work. And it really fueled me to, I guess, become an author in the way that I knew I wasn't content with just telling stories. Like, I love telling stories, but I also wanted it to reach readers, because I think it's different between, like, just writing something and then writing something reaching someone and having their reading of it kind of come back, like, in a, you know, back and forth relationship. So I think having that early exposure by putting my work online, all of that, it gave me the purpose of, like, okay, eventually I think the ultimate goal is to become traditionally published so that I can reach, like, you know, physical bookstores, I can get into libraries, I can go into, like, schools and all of that.
I think we are seeing a lot more work appearing online first through Wattpad.
Absolutely.
And I'm always been a really big defender of the place of fan fiction for young writers to explore their talents. So it's been really cool to see people who have started out online. Like if you look at something, say, Heartstopper at the moment is immensely popular, but Heartstopper started out on Webtoons, which you could say is the webcomic equivalent of Wattpad.
I guess like keeping that vibe going, we were just wondering, like, when this eventually hits air, like, you've got a chance to kind of speak to young writers that are in that space. Is there anything that you'd like to tell them?
Ooh, I guess to just keep going. Like, I know it's very, it's like very classic advice, right? Like, it's always the big thing. It's like, don't give up, try hard.
But that's important.
Do your best. It really is, though, because I feel like when you first start, it's so easy to kind of think, oh, well, I'm not good at this, or, you know, my work doesn't look like the way that I want it to. And I think it's because writing, or just storytelling in general, it's such a muscle that gets better and better with practice. And when you, like, first start, it won't ever look the way that you want it to. The thing is, the more you get at it, the easier it gets, but at the same time, it gets harder, right? Because your own expectations get really high. But in a way, that's a good thing, because it keeps yourself, you know, constantly on your toes, improving and improving. So I guess for, like, you know, young writers or just young people in general, it's like, don't give up. Like, genuinely, you know, even though it's the most cliche advice ever, don't give up, because eventually your work is going to look the way that you want it to, and the stories that you want to tell is worthy of being told.
Yeah. Speaking of, like, super worthy stories, like, big props, you've got a trans character in both your books, but also, like, writing muscle movement here, like, there's been some things that have happened to trans characters in novels, and, like, sometimes the treatment is just not what we'd like to see. So, like, how did you feel kind of approaching a character like that?
Yeah, I mean, queer representation in general is very important to me, because it's, like, especially I think in historical fiction, a lot of people will say, like, oh, well, you know, like, why are you inserting, like, modern sensibilities in, or something like that? But that's not the case at all, right? Because,
well, they're not modern.
Yeah, they're not modern. Queer people have existed through history, you know, forever. It's just that it's been brushed under the rug. So, you know, writing representation like that is really just writing the truth. It's writing how it actually used to be. And, you know, to me, it wasn't that I wanted to write a story that was about it, or it wasn't trying to investigate that kind of identity, or, like, you know, what it means, or, like, what that teaches, like, the rest of the audience, right? Like, it's not an educational thing at all. It's kind of like, people existed, and people can exist and go through angst, go through happiness, and then thrive in the same way that, like, the majority can, right? It's one of those things where it's just, for a reader to see themselves, it means more than, you know, the kind of casual appearance just means so much to a young person, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's what we are now starting to see a lot more in YA. Like, previously, YA literature was characterised as the problem novel of, here is a young person, something horrible has happened to them, and it's very contemporary and realistic. And I would say a lot of the stories featuring LGBT characters or people of colour were relegated to that as a genre. And in the, you've been writing, are you, sorry, you wrote for a spin-off an article about diversity in YA. Which I absolutely loved. You've done a lot of research into YA as a genre and literature. Okay, so you wrote an article for the spin-off about YA and how, as a publishing area, it's very trend-heavy. And it gets dominated a lot by whatever is seen to be the most marketable, most, something we can get the most amount of money out of. And you expressed concern that diversity could be one of those things now. You wrote the article a year ago, and since then we've seen a lot more stories appear in print. So looking at, say, HarperCollins' full lineup, all the covers, like, fully depict people of colour, written by authors who share the same identities. We've got, I hate to use Disney as a marker of cultural change, but if you look at...
It's happening.
Yeah. But if you look at, say, Turning Red came out this year, and they put a huge amount of investment into a Chinese-American telling her story. And we've got Kamala Khan appear on screen with the Miss Marvel show. It's a long-winded way of asking, do you feel like maybe the diversity is here to stay?
It's a hard question, right? Because it's one of those things where it's almost like it really depends on what these separate corporations will eventually, you know, get to. And there are so many different aspects at play, right? Because you see these big, you see these big projects getting funded, and it's almost like, is the investment happening because of like support, or because they're kind of seeing like, you know, the movement is here, like this is what's happening and all of that, or, you know, ultimately corporations are after money, right? Mm. Kind of that kind of thing. At least in young adult, like I will say, I think it is like, there's a lot of staying power of these, you know, books blowing up and all of that. And it feels like there is a lot of genuine support there. But of course, like, big corporations just care for themselves, like, at the end of the day. And it's one of those things where I think creators just have to constantly keep their foot, like, on corporations' necks to be like, hey, we're here. Don't forget about us. But, yeah, it's a very hard thing to kind of gauge, I will say. I hope that it is, you know, a time of creators being able to tell their own stories and reaching the readers who really need it. But I also think that we can't get lax and be like, oh, well, don't worry, like, you know, things are great and better now. Because I think the moment that people start easing up, it's very easy for, you know, people in power to be like, oh, well, we've had enough of these stories. Let's get back to how it used to be.
I think that's so difficult. I keep saying I think every time I introduce
it. You do have the brain cell. You're asking all the good questions.
Yes. One of the difficult things probably facing minority groups is that they want to be recognised. They want their stories heard, which often means having to sell them out to publishing groups, to companies like Disney. But then at the same time, these corporations and publishing groups may think, oh, we can get a ton of money out of this. People want to consume this, so we can sell it. But then you look at saying like way LGBT community has faced with Pride a lot, of, you know, the rainbow washing, the pink washing of stuff online. You think, is it going too far the other way now? Like, we're just another sort of token trend. So it's really interesting, like, hearing you talk about it. And as someone who, like, both of us, we work with YA books all the time, it's really exciting to see these new covers come through. It's also exciting, I think, just to, probably for our young people who come into the library, to see a face like theirs on the cover of a book is huge. So I do hope it stays. But as you have said, and have you written before, we have to see in 5 years' time, are those authors still being picked up by publishing houses? Are those characters still appearing? Or is it like, well, actually, why do we have to pay this, you know, new author to write it when we have, you know, a James Patterson equivalent who could just churn out another 5 novels about Chinese American culture, or that'd be
exactly
very
right. Yeah, it's about the long-term support, and I think we kind of see it where, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, well, this big author blew up. Okay, well, are we letting new ones come in as well? Like, are we treating them as individuals and not just like, oh, well, this is the next, you know, blank blank marginalized author? Like, are we cultivating the talent so that they are treated as individuals in the same way that majority groups would be treated as? But again, right, it's such a long-term thing into the future.
Sharon Lamb wrote, again, I love, sorry, I've read the spin-off so much. Sharon Lamb wrote an article about Asian publishing in New Zealand and how there isn't a lot of space in New Zealand for Asian or Southeast Asian Kiwis to publish their stories. We had recently the book, the anthology, what was it called? The Dawn, Claire the Dawn, which was edited by Chrissy. And I know you've talked about on in other interviews that you were prompted by the fact that you didn't see yourself in YA novels. And you've been writing a lot of the books set in Shanghai. Do you see yourself ever writing a novel set in New Zealand featuring Chinese Kiwis?
I have. So it's sitting in a drawer somewhere right now. So it's I have written it already. There was just something craft-wise about it that wasn't working. All to say, like, yes. Because right now, the YA books I've put out so far are all, like, in the same universe. So it's just, I've been kind of doing, like, you know, it's in-world. And then the next series I kind of want to work on is like sci-fi, so that it's, you know, also kind of in the other, you know, general area of like a different universe. But I do want to write something set in New Zealand and, like, actually publish it, because I feel like, in general, like, you know, I wrote about Shanghai, but otherwise in the YA market, it's very America-centric, which makes sense, right? You know, the majority of the book industry is in the US, and the kinds of stories that eventually get exported into New Zealand, I feel, are also just set in the States. So I think it'd be really cool to provide a story that kind of, you know, is for, like, New Zealand readers in a way that kind of, it caters to, like, a little, like, the way that I kind of think about my audience is that there's, like, a very, very tiny niche where I'm, like, it's my extreme target audience. But then I kind of have, like, a bigger niche that it's, like, my general target audience. And then it's, like, an even bigger circle where it's, like, anyone who enjoys my books. Like, if you enjoy it, we're all on the train together, right? But I think it's really fun to write for that extreme little niche and be like, oh, well, if you see yourself, that's really, really great. Does that make sense? The little niche circles.
I think that's probably what happens with a lot of publishing, is that originally when they pick up, say, a person who's not white, they go, well, maybe it's only other people of the same culture who will like this. Like, oh, we've got this book about African-Americans, so only African-American kids will read it. But hopefully if we promote it enough, some other kids. And I think that's a disappointing way to look at it, because especially in New Zealand, I think Pākehā teens would really value seeing. Like, when I was reading These Violent Delights, there's so much I learned about Shanghai. And I've been really privileged. Like, my partner's a Chinese Kiwi, and being his family have welcomed me in, and getting insight into their lives has really changed how I've seen Chinese Kiwis. And it makes me think, if I had a book that I picked up when I was 16, maybe some of the beliefs that I'd had would have been different. And that's that concept, really, of the, like, mirrors and doorways. It's, I think it's sometimes disappointing when publishing just wants to focus on, like, well, maybe just for five people will like that. But
it's one of those things where, you know, an author can have that specific audience they're speaking to, but then the audience that will be interested is so much bigger, right? And publishers can they can automatically assume, like, oh, well, if you're only speaking to the people who look like you, only those people will be reading it. But that's not true. You can be speaking to a specific little niche, but then it can also appeal to such a wide group who want to read about people different to them, right? Like, how boring would the world be if you only ever want to read about relatable characters?
Unlikable characters are also the best characters.
Exactly.
And what you said really sort of resonates, because when you look at publishing in New Zealand, we're a really small country. We have, there's less people living here than in, you know, New York. So I think publishing a novel in New Zealand would be quite difficult, because that, the potential audience gets even narrower and narrower. And you published your book in the US. Was that something which contributed to your reason why you sought out a publisher over there?
Absolutely, yeah. Because I knew that, you know, the majority of the book industry is in the US. And I wanted, you know, traditional publishing in the most traditional sense, where it had the major distribution. So I knew from the get-go that I wanted to get an American agent and target the American publishing houses. But of course, you know, I wanted my book at home as well. So I had the hope that once it got picked up in the States first, it would sell, you know, its sub-rights to the UK, and then eventually also then make its way into New Zealand. But I did take that route instead of directly applying to New Zealand publishers, because I knew, you know, as much as I do want my book to be here, there are certain limitations, which is not to say that, like, you know, I don't believe in the New Zealand book industry, or, like, I don't think it's as good. It's not that, right? It's, like, it's just the very, you know, the existing limitations of being a small country and just having less people. You know, it's just one of those things. So, yeah, I think because, like, the movement is over there, I was like, I'll go that way and then sneak my way back in.
You wonder if the New Zealand publishing industry has to, like, catch up in that way, and that they have to actually start looking not just on our shores, but what will appeal overseas as well. And I have noticed that when you look at, say, the New Zealand Children's Young Adult Book Awards, a lot of the novels which get nominated for shortlists are still very New Zealand-centric. But then you look at, saying, like, your books had huge success overseas, and who was it? For Hollow? The Ninth Hollow?
Oh, Getting the Ninth?
Yeah, Gideon Vinay. Mm. There we go.
That's my cousin's favourite thing.
Yeah, so Gideon Vinay has had huge success overseas, but it's very little known here in New Zealand.
Interesting, right? Yeah.
Maybe New Zealand just has a bit of cringe towards genre fiction. Mm. Like, I think we tend to pitch in New Zealand literature, especially New Zealand YA literature, as teens in New Zealand doing things like walking under kofi trees,
absolutely,
or listening to Tui's, or growing up in a tourist trap, rather than fantasy.
Yeah. I think there's kind of an existing assumption where New Zealand YA is only allowed to be about New Zealand, right? You have to mention, like, pohutukawa trees, like, three times on every page.
Quota.
Exactly, right? And I do think that limits it in a way because, you know, being a Kiwi is quite a vast experience that doesn't necessarily have to be the one narrative that I think, you know, you'll read about in your year 12, like, English study. Like, you're going to get a printout of a short story, and they're going to be like, this is the epitome of New Zealand YA. And I think it's much wider than that. And it is interesting to see what other New Zealand authors have kind of gone internationally instead. And, like, the example you mentioned, like, Gideon Vinay, I haven't read it yet, which is really shameful of me, but I've heard a lot of other Kiwis say that it feels so New Zealand, even though it is written as a fantasy. And I think it kind of bleeds through, like, if you're reading New Zealand authors who aren't necessarily writing about New Zealand, there's something still about it that reflects, you know, their upbringing.
And fantasy novels and sci-fi, a lot of people may think that they're quite shallow. Like,
they're wrong. Fantasy
can be used to explore social issues. Like, you've done that with your series exploring colonization. You have Juliet's pull between Western culture, which is becoming so much more dominant in her homeland, versus her traditions and her family, and you could explore that in a contemporary novel, but in a fantasy novel I think it's also more digestible for young people, and that's what we maybe sometimes forget about, is sometimes reality is too confronting, but a fantasy novel helps you explore it in a sort of safe manner. I mean, I was a little bit disappointed in the last awards when Aspiring won, which Aspiring is a fantastic novel. I really, really enjoyed it. But when I also read Tina Shaw's book Ursa felt more like a YA novel to me. And it was a dystopian. It had explorations of, you know, class, of, you know, your classic dystopian where you have the main characters impoverished, there's an upper class who are oppressing them, there's a potential rebellion. And people may look at that and go, that's not a Kiwi novel. Nothing about this sings New Zealand. The setting isn't New Zealand. But I'm sure there are tons of young people in New Zealand who think, why am I living in poverty? And if I cross to another suburb, they're living in wealth. I'm in, like, I can't get housing, I can't get food for my family. So I think we need fantasy and sci-fi in New Zealand. They really resonate with young people. So I'm hoping when the new the shortlist, you know, I think the long list comes out very shortly, when it comes out, I'm hoping to see some genre in it other than realistic and contemporary.
Yeah.
Not that I don't like it. I do enjoy it. But I'm still, like, a fantasy, so fan
there's,
of heart.
There's so much room. And especially for teens, right? Like, sometimes it's really fascinating to combine these kinds of, you know, tough issues, but also with a story that speaks of escapism, right? I think that's why, like, science fiction and fantasy is so fun to me, because it is this place where you can swing around a sword in a ball gown, like, you know, the classic dystopian where it was just girl facing away in a ball gown, right?
Yeah.
For no reason. It was a dystopian world. They were probably all starving, but she was wearing a ball gown.
Kira Cass's beautiful novel.
Yeah. So it has that element of, like, the kinds of stories that teenagers are so fascinated by, but also the things that are most concerning to them, like, all packaged up in one easily, you know, accessible novel.
I'm going to ask a question now.
No,
I'm not allowed to. It's Alicia's show.
Phil, pull her out.
No, Phil, Sophie. No, but I'm just thinking about the dresses because our lovely Moana, because I'm like, oh my gosh, we forgot about all the questions that got sent in by our library colleagues. And Moana is one of our web team, so you might have noticed her, like, retweeting and regramming and, like, putting little squeals on all of your
love
posts. She had a question, and effectively it's not a question, but she wants all of Julie's dresses.
Valid. I want all of them as well. I have been, ever since I published these Volantilites, I have been looking at, like, 20s flapper dresses, and I've bought two just for no reason. Like, they sit in my closet because where am I going to wear one, right?
Supermarket.
Yeah, I will. Okay, yeah. I will. Next time I go to Pack and Save.
Probably the best dressed person on Pack and Save.
No. Yeah, I felt like, oops, I forgot to ask like a little bit about Julie and Roma. I feel like that was a good, like, there was a good thing to go down. Like, I felt like we went down the hole of like genre publishing. And
I wanted to ask that.
And it's a beautiful place. But just quickly, like, what was your favourite scene between Julie and Roma?
Oh, that's a hard question. I guess my favourite scene... Oh, I was about to say a spoiler.
Keep going. That's fine.
I'm going to read the second book. I'm excited.
Yeah, we're bad librarians. We talked about this a lot. Like, we're going to have a bad librarian podcast, so we talk about all the books that we haven't read.
Well, actually, if anything, that makes you good librarians, yeah. Right? Because it means your, like, to-be-read pile is constantly really big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It means you're book lovers, if anything. Okay. I guess in the first book, my favorite scene is probably... the one in Mantua, right? Because it's like the culmination of their entire, like, I hate you so bad, but also I only hate you because of our complicated history. Like, I feel like it's when the secrets kind of come out and they get to, like, yell at each other and some, like, truth comes out. I always love writing those scenes where emotions are so highly charged because it makes it the most fun, you know? It's like everything's been building and building and building and then it gets to explode and I just go wild.
I have to admit, those are my favourite scenes in books as well.
I'm glad.
I feel like it's always very nice when you have this well-written characters with attention building up in each page. You're like, just tell each other you love
yes.
you.
Exactly.
Just say I love you.
Say something nice.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I can see through it all. But that's like also the essence of like the enemies to lovers trope
yes.
in romance.
Exactly.
God, what else did we write?
We wrote so many questions.
There's another side to this. Wait, please hold while I turn the paper.
No speaking.
Yeah. Actually, I've got a question. I want to ask a question about book talk.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things I've been seeing... I mean, I don't actually have TikTok.
I do.
You should.
Like, I don't have an account.
We're millennials, yeah. So we're only just getting into TikTok, so you'll be patient with us.
So like, Alicia's watching, listening to a podcast which talks about Instagram Reels.
No, it talks about TikTok. It's called In Case You Missed It.
I thought it was the three-part. Like, because I know I was watching the Instagram Reels of the stuff that was popular on TikTok 2 weeks ago, and you were doing the podcast on TikTok.
This is how millennials consume content now.
We need to be in the comfort zone. What was the question?
The question is...
Something, book talk.
You have been using TikTok a lot.
Yes.
And what I think I've been absolutely loving about it is we're seeing people just fully embracing those tropes, enemies to lovers. And... it's not bad writing. The tropes exist for a reason. Mm-hmm. We love them. And so I want to know, how have you been using TikTok? Mm-hmm. And how do you think it's factored into the success of your novel?
Yeah, I mean, I first started on TikTok just because I was trying to look for a place to have fun, honestly, which I think is the best kind of mindset to go into it with, because... I kind of stumbled onto an audience there where I was just posting about the kinds of books I liked. I was posting about The Cruel Prince a lot in the beginning. Like, I was just kind of just, you know, having fun on there, right?
I think and Holly then, Black's Cruel Prince is probably at the heart of book talk.
It is. It really is. It's so good, right? Because I was posting about it, like, frequently enough, it kind of drew a certain subsect of, like, enemies to lovers people, like, in my comments section. And it kind of made me realize, like, oh, wait, like, these people are the ones who would kind of enjoy my book. And I think this was, you know, before release. It was, like, June of 2020 or something. And because I was kind of realizing that, I then made a few videos where I was like, oh, you guys like these books? You should look out for my book that's coming out, like, in November. And it kind of organically, like, picked up an audience that way, which I'm really, really grateful for. And I think the thing that we're seeing recently now with TikTok kind of becoming big is publishers telling authors to jump on because it's a good marketing platform, which sometimes backfires. Because if you're jumping on there to market, teenagers and especially Gen Z really, really hate ads being marketed to. They know. The moment you're saying anything that sounds like it could be a hashtag ad or hashtag spawn, they're like, and they flip away so fast, right? So I think, like, book talk is so much more organic than any other platform has been because it relies so heavily on, like, you know, authentic love rather than like, oh, well, someone sent me this free gifted copy and that's why I'm raving about it. But yeah, I kind of lost my train of thought. I hope that answered the question.
No, because thinking we've been looking at BookTok a lot because our readers are actually super informed by it. Like, I like to go and spy on the hold list for the BookTok books. I did that this morning just so I was like there.
It's how readers now are finding their books.
Absolutely.
More and more teens are coming in and asking us for titles that are popular on TikTok. Like, oh, I saw this video about Colleen Hoover. Do you have Colleen Hoover's books? Yeah. I'm like, no.
Not for teens.
They can have it.
We just
don't have any. Like, it's immense. Like,
Love Hypothesis has got 130 holds on it. So, like, but also your books also currently unavailable at the moment because it's got a whole lot of holds on it. And, I guess we spend a lot of our time like preempting that and like looking at these books that are super popular, like yours, and trying to find kind of reader likes. Like, oh, you would absolutely love this. Mm. So what would you recommend to our readers that will probably want to go out and grab a copy of your book? And if there's still a holds list, what should they pick up just while they wait?
Oh, good question. Okay. There's an upcoming book that's, it's not out yet, but it's called If You Could See the Sun by Anne Leong. She's actually Australian. And it's about this girl who is, she's enrolled in private school, but she's a scholarship student. And then one day she discovers that she has the power to turn invisible. And she teams up with her academic rival who, like, has been trying to, like, beat her for the top class position for, like, years, right? And they team up to start this kind of, like, business where they will find secrets for other people. Because it's, for her, it's a scheme to get money, and for him, maybe he's just been interested in her the whole time, right? You know, academic rivals, all that. It is so good, but I don't think it's coming out until October. So everyone just put that on your radar.
It's on HarperCollins full cover release. I was immediately drawn to it because it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Oh, it's beautiful, like pastel blue and pink clouds washing over. Again, people on covers is coming back.
Yes.
At least they're not in ball dresses. Mm. That's beautifully
illustrated. That'd be a fun trend to come back, though. Yeah, but it is, oh my god, it is such a good book. I think anyone who likes, it's not quite enemies to lovers, but it has that vibe. And I think anyone who's really into the kind of like, I hate you, but maybe I love you, will really, really love this book. It's one of the first books in a while that actually made me like lay down on my bed and kick my legs, you know?
Like, ah,
I know! I'm like, ee! Just that kind of feeling. What else? I think, The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea by Axie O, which is out already.
That's in my car.
Love that. It is so good. Be prepared to cry, though. Not in a sad way, but in a, like, there's so much love in my heart kind of way. Yeah.
I read it on the couch and just sit there, like, weeping.
Yes, that's exactly what I did.
Holding it out so I don't cry on the love of the book because that would be bad.
Yes.
Ooh, it's beautiful looking.
I know, you can have it after me. I'll read it fast. Yeah. We were actually sharing your book to read it on time because we were like, we can't be bad librarians for this one. We have to read.
I just want to be smug and say I requested your book to be ordered because I was trying to make a book list of books which were by Chinese authors. And I'd been Googling, like, Chinese books YA, Chinese books fantasy YA, and your book, before it was released, came up on, like, an article of, here's 10 books you have to read. And I was like, oh, perfect.
Amazing.
So I placed it on hold. I was like, and then I waited, like, 6, 8, 10 months during the pandemic for it to arrive in New Zealand. And you must have appeared on a spin-off or it became news in New Zealand that you were on the New York Times bestseller. And suddenly the hold list exploded. And I was very smugly senior. Look at me.
You're like, I was ahead of the trend.
I knew about Hong Kong before all of you. So I was very excited when it arrived. But admittedly, I haven't gone to a second book yet, so I'm very much looking forward to that. Because as librarians, our to-read pile is huge. And
it's really bad.
With TikTok exploding, I'm trying to catch up. Like, I'm reading The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, which was
so good.
Phenomenal and deserves all the recognition. So good. I've got The Atlas 6, I think it's
so good. Oh, I love that book. I love it.
I'm very excited to read it. It's sitting in my living room. I'm like, put it in a shrine. I'm like, I'm going to read you, I promise. And I have to because there's, like, again, a phenomenal amount of people waiting on the list for it. So it's just exciting to see how TikTok is driving people to read again. And as you said, I think a lot of it comes to, it's because it is now a place where people can be their authentic selves.
Yes.
we are seeing lots of, especially young women, who finally have a space just to be excited about reading.
Absolutely.
And I find that, you know, fangirls are always, like, derived. Well, not derived. Another D word I can't remember. They're always... Fangirls seem to be always looked down upon as childish.
Right. Ashamed?
Yeah.
Mm.
And it's unfair because we should be allowed to feel excited about something which brings us pleasure. And books can do that. We are hoping as a library to try to get into that space. We know that's how people are getting their recommendations now. So what are some tips for two millennial librarians?
We don't want to be cringe.
Yeah, trying to find success on TikTok recommending books.
Okay, the first thing is don't zoom in on your face. I have noticed.
Delete that video. No,
I'm kidding. There's this thing that other people have noticed first. Like I picked up on it because I saw these comparison videos and I laughed so hard. Where Gen Z love to film usually like from below, like up. And then millennials will hold it from here, and usually they'll start recording and they'll zoom in on their face really big first, and then they'll zoom back out, and it's like comedy for that. So sick. I think it's so funny, but at least on TikTok, don't do that. Well, you can do it if you want.
Some of them have gotten massive because they're so funny. Like Bridie Arrow, the youth librarian, showed me one from an American library of like really old lady being like, "Oh, would you look at that? A book checking out machine. Let's check it out." And then, like, she like walks slowly over it, and it's just exploded because it's so cringe.
Honestly, no. Sometimes sometimes you have to embrace the cringe. I think sometimes the cringe works for a reason. You know, it's your authentic self if it's cringe.
We're not cringe. We're not cringe.
We're pretty awful.
No, but I think the lovely thing about like TikTok and BookTok specifically is that, so long as you just really love the things that you're talking about and you're just trying to get these recommendations out, like, people pick up on it. Like, they really love to talk about the books. They really want to, like, gather together to discuss what they liked, what they disliked, what they are looking forward to. And it's just such a nice space that I think anyone coming in to use it authentically and who's actually enjoying themselves, it really shows through.
I think we're getting looked at. I can't remember how long we booked this room for. Probably not this long.
No.
All right.
I think we have covered a good amount of things. Like, is there anything you want to add to help promote your book or... Yeah.
Anytime I'm asked, was there anything we missed? I'm like, just blank buy noise.
Nothing. Buy my book, please.
Please buy my books. And thank you guys for chatting with me.
That's no problem. We absolutely loved it. And, hopefully people will be placing holds on your book or coming to your events and buying copies from their local bookstore.
Yes. Support local bookstores.
Not Amazon. <Yes. laughs> We know shipping is expensive in New Zealand, but do support your local bookstores. Yes, and especially check to your local bookstore people. Yes. They will have tons of recommendations. Our local one is fantastic. Mm.
Booksellers are amazing. Librarians are amazing. That's how I'll end this one.
I like that.
Thanks. Oh, my legs.
Oh, did you... Every summer we do the Summertime Reading Challenge, trying to get kids and teens to read. And basically the challenge is to describe a book in three words. Mm-hmm. We were wondering if you would be open to doing a short little video holding up your book and just describing it in three words.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Right now?
We prepared a copy.
Okay.
Is it gone? There it is.
Hidden under the paper.
It's been loved.
Okay, well, let me think what my three words are.
Yeah. Have you got steady hands?
I can't even use a tripod. That's because I'm...
I know. Alicia bought the wrong phone case and it like falls out of the tripod. Like you go to sit on it just like gently falls down and we're just like...
All these teens are walking past and these me and Alice have a tripod trying to like filming. We're like, we know what we're doing.
Stop looking at us.
So like, I just gave it to some teens to film TikToks instead.
They loved it. It was fine. This curtain's nice.
I love that this is well loved. I love looking well loved.
Okay, tell me when I should. Oh, wait, how should I start it? Should I be like the three words to describe this?
Maybe you just say introduce yourself?
Okay. Yeah. Okay, introduce